Hello and welcome. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to all of you, and also to our listeners tuned in across the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world via the World Wide Web. Welcome to all of you. My name's Amy McQuire. I've been filling in for Tiger on Thursdays, and it's always a bit daunting. I have big shoes to fill. My country's up in Rockhampton in central Queensland. I'm Darumbal in South Sea Islander. Today I thought we'd talk about an issue that hasn't been on the agenda as much as it should. Thankfully, this year it received a bit more coverage than it has in the past. The issue of domestic violence or family violence. As I said, it's finally now on the public agenda with the current Australian of the Year, Rosie Batty, spearheading a campaign to break the silence around the issue. But although this is sorely needed and long awaited for, sometimes it feels that Aboriginal women are again left out of the equation. And that's despite the shocking statistics. Aboriginal women are 34 times more likely to be victims of family violence than non-Indigenous women. It's a shocking statistic. But it also conceals a number of other distressing facts. Earlier this week, the Aboriginal Children's Commissioner in Victoria, Andrew Jacquemos, addressed the state's Royal Commission into Family Violence. There was one day devoted to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander issues. He raised a really troubling fact that Aboriginal women are being denied bail and put on remand, largely because there was a lack of safe emergency accommodation for them to go to. So our women, our Aboriginal women, who are the fastest growing incarcerated group in the country, are being put in jail while they await sentencing because there's no other safe place for them to go. Jail becomes the safest place for them. That's shocking. Now, the Royal Commission also heard from Muriel Blambert, the head of the Victorian Aboriginal Childcare Agency. 400 Aboriginal children were taken off their families and placed into care in the state between 2013 and 2014 alone. That's in 1 year. And 88% of that was due to family violence. Now, Aboriginal children who come into contact with the child protection system are more likely to end up in jail, continuing the cycle. Aboriginal children who grow up in violent homes are more likely to replicate that violence when they're older, again continuing the cycle. So it's obvious these issues are complex and complicated and interrelated, and they aren't just going to be solved by talking about one aspect of family violence. And it's obvious that our voices, which aren't heard in the national conversation, are being ignored yet again. Often Aboriginal women are being talked about, Aboriginal women are being talked to. Basically, Aboriginal women aren't given the space to talk, even though this is an issue crippling our communities. I want to open with a quote, with a comment from Judy Atkinson.
I really do respect the present Australian of the Year, the focus on what's been talked about. That's her business. But the business that we have to be about as Aboriginal people are much bigger than that. It's much more complex than that. It's about how police are confused when they enter a domestic and they charge on both a man and a woman. Yes. How the system itself will remove children without supporting that woman in some way. How the mental health system can allow a man who's clearly got an acquired brain injury, a mental health issue, not to get the services that he needs. It's all part of a whole.
That was Judy Atkinson, an Aboriginal woman and a traumatologist who has had a long history working in the field of family violence, particularly in Aboriginal communities. She has a wealth of experience, so we'll be hearing a bit more from her later and about her concerns about where the conversation is heading. First of all, I wanted to open up with the story of strong Aboriginal women in communities in Western Australia and how their campaign to help eradicate family violence suffered a momentary setback. The Safe House on the Dampier Peninsula was set up by the Jarrajin Aboriginal Corporation. It opened its doors only a year ago, but this year was immediately threatened under the Abbott government's chaotic Indigenous Advancement Scheme. Now, the Safe House, which services 4 remote communities and 50 outstations, was critical and in 1 year helped reduce domestic violent rates. But when it applied under the IAS for funding, they were rejected. The decision has thankfully since been overturned, and the service has been granted $250,000 a year in funding for the next 3 years. The safe house was set up by strong Aboriginal women. One of them was Bernadette Angus, who saw the effect that domestic violence was having on her community intimately. In fact, women who were looking for a safe place would come to her house. Here's her story.
What was it like before the safe house, would you say?
That when they were here, some used to come to my house in the community. Some women used to come with their little kid, used to run away from their husband and have a good sleep. So I used to give them room. So I said, my house is not a, you know, place to safe. Women would get hurt or something. But when the husbands used to go look for their wives, then I used to say, oh, they here, they right, they safe. They just come off a cool off. So you go, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, they have to understand our people here. They didn't make any humbug. But at least they knew where they wives were. Some of them used to come to me. I have a couple of women used to come different times. They used to come and have a relaxed sleep. And they used to get up next morning, they used to go back home because their husbands used to be sober, but didn't have no arguments. They felt fresh and they realized too, you know. Then I used to talk to the men, I'd say, they just run away because of you being overheated. They come off for cool off.
Yeah.
You get a cool off too. They don't run away forever. They just want to have a little relax. There must be some nervous and they just want to have a good sleep, especially the kids, take little kids away. They don't want violence or whatever.
It wouldn't have been a good place for you, would it? Because if you've got, I mean, it's not the best situation, them coming to your house, is it?
No, but it was all right. I used to be, they went to room or something, you know, when they were in town?
Yeah.
And I stayed here with my sister. They just come to have company, and but it was all right.
Yeah.
We didn't have none of my problems.
So why is the safe house so important then, do you reckon?
Oh, the safe house here in this community is important because when women from other communities, you know, when they come back, come here and have a good rest, or, you know, relaxed.
Yeah.
And especially for old people like myself, my sister, a few other ladies, it's too much noise in the community. They might wouldn't want to stress. So we just come here to the safe house, have a good sleep, could have a good rest, relax, you know, feel good. That's good that we have a safe house and it's so relaxing and it's really, everyone are happy about the safe house, ladies. We're trying to get more ladies involved coming to have cup of tea, sit down, talk, give ideas and helping each other out.
Yvonne Sampi is another strong Aboriginal woman from One Arm Point, which is one of the communities involved in the safe house, and she was directly involved in setting up the safe house. A lot of that stemmed from her own experiences. She's a survivor of family violence, and she's also one of a pillar of strength in the community. First of all, I spoke to her about what Aboriginal women did before the safe house and what she's seeing happening in her community right now.
Why was that so important? What was missing in the community, do you think?
Because we didn't have any access to going into Broome. It's a long way to drive 240 k's out of town to have a woman and children go on a dirt track and go away from the community. That's why we decided to have one here.
Did you find a lot of women would stay in the situation because they couldn't go to Broome?
Yes, exactly. A lot of women, I myself was one of them, couldn't go because it was very far to leave and no vehicle, no access really to go into Broome. But here it's, you know, very close. It's just a hop, skip and a jump, really.
One of the interesting things about the safe house is that it's not just about providing a safe place for women, it's about also caring for the vulnerable men in society. And it's obviously an issue that women like Yvonne Sampi cares about. And she talks in this next grab about the reasons why we have to tackle family violence as a whole community and move away from demonising a section of it, namely Aboriginal men.
Do you think, have you seen any difference in the community since the safe house has been operating?
Yep. There's less domestic violence, and the children are much happier, and they know they can have a place to go to if they need to. And, yeah, overall, the men have also know that they have can have a one-on-one with mediation, with men's outreach. If they need help, they know that they can get help through us too. Because we're not only there for the woman, we're there to help the men too.
What was how would you describe domestic violence, and why do you think there is so much of it around in our communities?
Well, there's a lot of alcohol and drug abuse in our community right now. It's very hard because it comes in by the truckloads, really, from Broome. You know, people just go into town and grab some alcohol, drugs, and they sell it here to our own people, and that's what we need to focus on later on to try and stop all this alcohol and drugs.
Yeah, right. And the safe house, when you talk about domestic violence going down, how have you seen that? I mean, how are you able to measure that? Is it just through, like, people saying that, women saying they feel a lot safer in the community?
Yes, it's, because a woman saying is they feel a lot safer now, they can a place to stay. Yeah. And as for myself, I've been through it for so many years. I had to just run to my parents, run to family's home, and I didn't have the sort of place to just go and hide. It was very hard, and I had to go back each time because I always thought that my ex-husband was the breadwinner. I had no idea I could do it on my own. So I think a lot of women see that I've done what I've done because I've been through it so much, and they know that I'm a member of the Safe House team, and they say to themselves, if she can do it, I can do it. And a lot of women have expressed that to me too.
Yeah, wow. So you're seen as sort of an inspiration.
And yes, exactly.
Yeah, and you got out of that situation before the Safe House, did you?
Yes, yeah. I did. Yes.
Do you think it would have been easier and you could have got out earlier if you had?
Oh, yeah, I would have done that earlier, but yeah, it took me so long. But the young people here, they sort of like, oh, it's shame to talk about things, it's shame to do that. And we sort of sit down and we talk to the ladies and tell them, okay, if you need to go away from your hubby, we're not going to separate you, we just need to help both of you, like we help them, have a talk to them and see where they're going. And the men know that we are here to help the ladies, to support them and not to take them away, because that's what I usually thought before. You know, when the woman's going to Broome, or their wife's going to run away and leave them for good. But it's not the case here. We sort of help both of them.
Yeah, because I think it's interesting what you said about men and supporting your men as well. And it's the stuff you don't hear about around the country. Why is it so important to support men and Aboriginal men?
Well, a lot of men are very vulnerable as for children's sake. A lot of people tend to commit suicide because they haven't had their wife and their children left them and stuff like that, because it's hard for them to cope with things like that. They go turn to alcohol and drug abuse, and they feel there's nothing left for them, and that's what we're trying to stop our people from doing that. Because a few of our boys from one point have committed suicide because their partners took their children away and never had access to them. I am a perfect example of that. I lost one of my boys to suicide 8 years ago. His girlfriend took away his little boy and he committed suicide because he wasn't allowed access to him. Yeah. And it's a very sad thing for me, but I don't get to see him much. But apparently he was here at one point the other day and no one told me about him. So, it was very hard finding out yesterday.
It's a very sad situation because I think especially non-Indigenous Australians don't realise that it affects the whole community, doesn't it?
Yes, it
every
does.
Every little thing, yeah.
Yes, it does.
Are you seeing a change in the men when you go and talk to men and they want to access services?
Yes, the men have... they've mellowed somehow, you know. Before it was like, I'm the man, I'm the boss. But it's now a two-way street, you see it? It's not like before. You see, my ex-husband, I used to, like, I was the one, I'd done everything. I'd done the cooking, I'd done the cleaning, I looked after the kids. But now you have men, you know, looking after their children, you know, changing their nappies and stuff like that with the boys. And, they're cooking, feeding, and looking after them. I've never seen that before.
And that's all because of the programs and the culturally appropriate programs in the safe house.
Yes.
And I guess it's only you and strong women like yourself who can deliver it. It can't be outsiders, can it?
Yes, it's just us, a strong woman like me, doing stuff like this. And I get appreciated from a lot of people, Aboriginal and non-Indigenous people. And they say to me, oh, you know what, you're very inspirational. I went to, I worked at the mines for 4.5 years, and in 2013 I was asked to make a speech on how I got into the mine with domestic violence and losing my boy to suicide, and I had a standing ovation in Perth. Ladies were crying, and a guy said to me, we really need to write a book about you, girl, and I said, no, I'm not an inspiration. I'm just a survivor, and I tell everyone that, you know, I'm not inspirational. I just work towards myself just to be strong, and therefore I think a lot of women saw that I done it, so they can do it too.
Dawn Thompson is a coordinator at the Safe House. She's happy that the Safe House has been granted funding over the next 3 years, but says that the issue, the life or death nature of the work that they do, means that there has to be a greater funding commitment, a long-term funding commitment, when we talk about funding essential services like women's shelters. The Safe House is already only one year old, but you've already notched up quite a lot of success, haven't you? What have you seen in the community?
We have. I mean, since opening on the 1st of September, so that was last year, we have seen a drop in domestic violence rates, which we've had 70 women and children who have come and used the Safe House, so they've had a safe place to come to. And really, you know, community have welcomed the Safe House because they wanted it, yeah.
There was some concerns that you wouldn't get funding, but that's since been overturned. When did you hear
that's
about
right.
that?
That's yeah. right. Yeah, yeah. We were concerned that we didn't have funding. We heard at the end of May our IAS funding application was being reviewed, and we found out at the middle of June that we had funding, allocated funding under the IAS for the next 3 years.
What would have happened if you didn't get that funding?
If we hadn't got the funding, basically women and children in the communities of the Dampier Peninsula would have been an ongoing risk of domestic violence, and in the extreme could be at risk of homicide.
It's very much almost a life and death situation, isn't it, these funding decisions from government occasionally?
They are, and I think that government needs to, whilst it's great that government has funded this project in recognition of it being an essential service, these projects that fund essential services need to be longer term, and, you know, we shouldn't have to apply for them every few years. I mean, it's providing a safe place for women in community. Otherwise, these women are at real risk.
And hopefully the Safe House up on the Dampier Peninsula continues to receive funding because it obviously runs an essential service. It's just one women's shelter out of many across the country. Obviously, a lot of the national narrative, as stated before, is based around mainstream services. That's a problem, according to Judy Atkinson, who says that we have to look at family violence as a whole. It's not just about women's shelter. It's about changing and healing a lot of the trauma of the past. Now, Judy Atkinson has been involved in trying to understand and help heal victims of family violence for a very long time, stretching back to, I think, the 80s. She's an Aboriginal woman whose roots stretch into Bundjalung country, and she's a really respected, strong Aboriginal woman. She talked to me about the importance of recognising the intergenerational links of family violence and how colonisation has contributed to it, because without understanding these links, we have almost no hope to solve it. This is Judy Atkinson talking today about women's refuges, but also family violence more generally. I mean, it's been a bit in the news this year because of Rosie Batty getting Australian of the Year. Do you think Aboriginal women have been left out of the national conversation?
I believe they've been left out from the beginning. I can remember when I first started to name issues of domestic or family violence. It was made clear to me that people wanted to talk about family violence and harm of children in that process, that there seemed to be a threat from the non-Aboriginal women who were pushing the agenda at that time. And I have two stories that I like to relate. One was a woman coming right up into my face and saying, and I was the only Aboriginal woman that was involved in trying to, at that particular meeting, getting the agenda up. And she gets right into my face and she says, "But we get bashed too, you know." And I went, "There's 11 other women in this room, and I'm the only Aboriginal woman," and yet she had to make the point that they get bashed too. Well, the whole agenda was about them. And then another woman turned around in that same meeting and said, "Oh, but your men wouldn't do things like that. You know, they've been colonised." And we were talking then about domestic violence. So the other part of that story that I want to make a point on is that then within the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, as it was in those days when Janet Ramsay was in charge of the educational program to address violence issues, there was a conference that was one of the first conferences that I was aware of that was being pulled together in Adelaide. And I had done a whole program across Australia for that time. And so I raced around and got a whole lot of our mob to come, including our men, because they had contributed substantially to the documentary video I made, Beyond Violence, Finding the Dream, which was focused on that. You know, one thing positive in each state that we could use to address violence issues. And we got into the conference and there were women who stood up and attacked the men who were there. So in other words, my theme was that men are part of the solution, let's get down and all talk together. So I invite them all to come to this conference, and they were made to feel very unwelcome. So not only have we been cut out of the dialogue, but when we have stood up and wanted to speak out and we wanted to make space for all our family members, our elders and our men in particular, to be heard as well, back then we were cut down. We were told, you know, this was a women's issue and we had to focus on women. Now we're saying, well, this is a men's issue. So we've led the way at so many levels on this, you know, and yet we've had to fight every step of the way.
I think it's interesting you mention the experience you had, because the current discourse around this is that men should be excluded and women's voices do need to be heard more. But yeah, we saw with, particularly in our communities, I mean, when you're talking about power, Aboriginal men are powerless in a sense as well. They've had their power taken away from them. Is that something that Australia just doesn't seem to understand when we talk about family violence in Aboriginal communities?
I think the work of Marita Blanco in South America and Maria Campbell's work also in her book Halfbreed tells us some things. So if we look at the impacts of colonisation, we see that the colonising processes disempower men. They're killed, they're imprisoned, and their women are sexually used in different ways. And it might have been negotiated, because sometimes in a war zone that's what you do. And the next generation men start to use alcohol and other substances as their cultural and spiritual identities are eroded. And in the third generation, we know that then And I'm now talking about trauma, social trauma, cultural trauma starts to creep in. And we start to see this thing that we have called domestic violence, gender-based violence. We've got all these terminologies. Aboriginal people have called it family and community violence. And into the fourth generation, we start to see where the abuse of children comes into that whole disintegration of cultural and spiritual ways, of social ways of being in the world and working out our relationships together. So we haven't taken those things into consideration. And I had a discussion just last week from somebody who rang up about some educational programs on youth offending. And he said, do you think that the mainstream programs will also apply to Aboriginal youth? And I said, no. But I do know, and we work this one out in other places, that if we start with developing programs specific to Aboriginal needs, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander needs, from the colonising place, which is a patriarchal place, then those programs will apply to all of Australia. But if we continue to think that mainstream programs are going to reach Aboriginal people, they will continue. Our people will continue to be marginalised and dispossessed further from a product that has come out of the colonising processes.
And that's what we're seeing currently, isn't it? There's a lot of talk about the fact that mainstream women's refuges and shelters have been defunded, but we don't hear about Aboriginal women's shelters or refuges. Are Aboriginal women expected to just access those mainstream services?
That's the way it's being pushed, and then they're pulling the plug from those mainstream services as well. One of the best Aboriginal women's shelters that I ever saw was the Kawara Women's Shelter in Sydney, set up originally by Pansy Hickey. And I want to name that because it did some things that a lot of women's shelters don't do. It invited psychologists, doctors, others to come in and work, not just with the women, but with their children as well, in a very therapeutic way. So it wasn't just giving women shelter. It was giving them an opportunity to look more deeply at why they were going back to those situations of abuse and what harm was happening on the children. Now, to my knowledge, I heard a few years ago that Kawara was defunded. I know that in 1989-90, when I did some work around Australia, Aboriginal women wanted women's shelters. And so we came back to Canberra and they were funded. And they gave women respite. And now what we're hearing, excuse me, that was my little dog, I'll just go back on that one.
Oh, no problem.
So women's shelters gave women respite and gave them a chance to think about if they wanted to stay in this relationship, if they wanted to get out. What the women, Aboriginal women from the women's shelters told me is that, yes, they had shelters, but they didn't have the skills to work in the way they felt they needed to with the women. And so my focus became education. But if you look at the Royal Commission in Victoria now, I think there's something very, very dangerous that's happening. Aboriginal women's incarceration rates across Australia have risen dramatically since the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. And I know personally a number of women who have taken the rap on something and chosen to go to prison to take some time out.
Wow.
And they've taken time out from the grog, the drugs that they've been using to medicate themselves. I also read yesterday that some women are choosing, Aboriginal women in New South Wales are choosing to use ice so they get superhuman strength so they can fight back. Now, none of these things are solutions. I think that women's shelters are a place where women and their children, and there's problems with some women's shelters for Aboriginal women because they may have more children than the shelter wants to take in, or their boy children may be over the age that the women's shelter will accept boy children. So Aboriginal women's shelters are very important. And yes, they're being defunded, but I want to now make a claim that it's much, much more than that. So many of the women that I know who are in ongoing domestic violence where their life is at risk, also have alcohol and other drug problems. They've also been abused as children, harmed as children in different ways. They've come out of institutionalised settings. Just about every... No, I shouldn't say that. That's too a broader statement. Many of the women that I've worked with who have been removed and placed in institutional settings as children, that's the child removal policies that this, the governments have progressed, came out early, got into a relationship looking for love, found that it was love that also included battering, abuse, and then picked up the alcohol and other drugs, felt that they couldn't look after their own children, and have seen that pattern repeat itself, not just with their own children, but now in their grandchildren. I have sat with grandmothers whose hearts are actually splitting apart, bleeding, because they feel that they've never healed from what happened to them as children in the institution, where they experienced different forms of abuse. In looking for love, which they never got as a child, they got into an early relationship, often with white men, by the way. They got battered really badly. There was racism involved in that. Their own children suffered, and now they see their own children behaving in a similar way on their grandchildren. So there's a generational thing here that we need to be looking at. It's more than just women's shelters. It's a whole approach to the woman's needs, the children's needs, and to the man's needs. Because quite often those men have got horrendous experiences as children. Am I allowed to talk about men for a while?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Definitely. This is all, really important.
Yeah, so. my daughter, Caroline Atkinson, did her PhD in Australian correctional centres, and she sat with Aboriginal men who'd committed quite horrendous crime. And quite a bit of it was violence on women. Well, pretty well all of it was. What the tragedy was is that none of them had ever been allowed to explore what had happened to them as children. So one little fella at three saw his mother shot in the head with a shotgun, was made to clean it up. He committed a crime and he probably won't be released from prison for that crime. He also was sexually abused when he was in the institution after he was taken there, when he, after he was removed, you know, after his father went to prison, after his father had killed his mother. Now, we may judge that young man, but what was he taught as a child? And in my daughter's PhD, she sat with our men in prison, and she found that quite often the crimes they committed were almost identical to what had happened to what they'd seen as children, the violence that she'd seen as children. And yet at no stage had the legal service brought any of these issues out and pleaded for them in court. At no stage were any of them ever given any kind of therapy in the prison environment to help them look at their behaviours, change their behaviours. And well over 50% of them, had a clear diagnosis of complex post-traumatic stress disorder. So it says a lot about our prison system as well.
It does. Now, and it also says a lot about the way the debate's framed as a feminist issue. I mean, is it even a feminist issue? It's very much an issue affecting Aboriginal communities specifically, isn't it?
It is. And a lot of our women now are going to jail for violence on their partners. So, for example, in New South Wales, male homicides, a third of the Aboriginal men in New South Wales, and I need to balance this, and I'll start with the men. Between 2009 and 2010, of the 35 male homicides, a third were Aboriginal men. Of the 108 female homicides, 12% were Aboriginal women. Of the children who died in domestic homicide between the ages of 0 to 4, 15% of them were Aboriginal children. Now, why am I saying that? Because we have to support women trying to escape domestic violence, family violence, gender-based violence, whatever you want to call it. But we also need to understand that our children are being affected tremendously. A child who witnesses violence in the home experiences it. Yes. And there is enough research now to show that it harms them in their brain development, in their neurodevelopment, that they are more likely as boy children to go on and harm young girls as they get into their adolescence and into their relationships. And girl children are more likely then to think that this is a normal way of living and go into relationships where they're being abused in some way. All of this is part of a whole. It's not a separate issue. And what frustrates me, and somebody said this to me, and I think it's true, white fellas, and I'll use that terminology, the Western world, what it does, it looks at one problem and it doesn't see the interrelationships that contribute to that problem. But in looking at that one problem, it then makes the most complex response to it, a response that most of us can't follow. Aboriginal people, black fellas, what our mob do is they look at one issue and they see it in the context of the whole. They see the interrelationships. And they will sit and talk about it. They will talk about it for a long time. And when they come up with solutions, the solutions are grounded deeply within the human capacity to do something. Really simple solutions about talking with each other, listening to each other, understanding our pain, working out how we can do things differently so that we don't do this. But we're not given the voice. The people who control the dialogue believe they have answers for us, but they don't sit down with us to bring those answers to the fore, to make them happen.
And this is a direct, this insidious cycle is very much a direct consequence of the stages you were talking about stretching back into colonisation, isn't it? And it's something that the voices who speak on behalf of us don't talk about or aren't willing to talk about or don't seem to be aware of even.
I think that it's critical that we get an understanding of what colonisation does to human groups. And here in this country, we need to start to name and know how we now are perpetrating on our children, between our young people and between men and women, some of the violence that has come out of that colonising process, on the processes, the generational trauma, as I call it. I also believe, however, that non-Aboriginal Australia needs to look at itself in that way as well, because, after all, the master colonisers were the Romans. And they colonised England, and England became, the British became our colonisers now today.
Going back to the women's shelters, I mean, when you look at, you said they were in a way critical, but what are the barriers that Aboriginal women face when they go to these shelters?
Well, in the places I've been, for a start, it might be 600 kilometres to get to a shelter. It might be a 10-hour drive. You might be in a remote community where you just can't get out. In a town, it might be that you don't have any money. You can't get a taxi. It might be that when the police are called, they look at what's happening and they charge both the woman and the man for disruptive behaviour, instead of putting the woman into a taxi and taking her over to a shelter. It may be that she has a lot of children, and so therefore the shelter doesn't accept that number of children, or a boy child who's over the age of 10 or something like that. There are many barriers, and they're large. My experience is that when Aboriginal women have been able to run shelters, that they do a good job. But I'm aware now of shelters where women are being asked to pay a fee for being there. You could call it a rental or whatever, for being there. And I know women who've never, Aboriginal women who've never, ever been able to control the money. That every bit of money that comes into that family is controlled by that man. And he uses it for drugs, he uses it for grog, or he uses it for gambling, because that's his generational pattern. He's gone three generations without a job. There's all sorts of reasons why women can't access shelters, nor do they know how to operate within a system where they have to log on to a computer, where they have to... There's all sorts of things.
And if an Aboriginal woman is turned away from a shelter because of one of these reasons, where do they go? Is that a problem as well?
Generally, they'll move to another family member's place for a while. When I wrote the book Trauma Trails, I had seen by that time that there was a trauma trail where people moved from one place of the pain, the distress, the disaster to another. So other family members then take that responsibility on. And sometimes it disrupts their own family when they're trying to cope, and it creates tension in their own family. Some women will move to different places, but then if to different family members. But then if you've been a woman who was removed as a child and is coming out of those kinds of situations where she's coming out of an institutional environment, she hasn't got an extended family to rely on. And in domestic violence, as we know, the domestic assailant will try to block her from having any friends or contact with family. So there's all of those issues as well.
Yeah, and I guess the funding issue as well, when they get to these services and don't find the culturally appropriate services they may need, what happens then? Where does the rehabilitation come in? I mean, how many women end up going back to the people who are abusing them?
I know one situation in particular that I'm aware of right this minute where she did go back and then she took the rap for something he did and spent another spate of time in prison. And that's when she got healthy and clean again, because as soon as she goes home and he's there, her husband, you know, with all the children they have, the husband has got his own mental health issues. I'm not sure if that's he's got an acquired brain injury, people think. So, yes, that woman, it's like a merry-go-round of getting away if you can and then being pushed to come back. And I know if I talk about the Stockholm syndrome, some people will understand what I'm talking about and others won't. So it's that time when you've been made a prisoner and then you start to give alliance to the person who's made you prisoner, the person who's hurting you. There's a love-hate relationship. You run from it, you go back to it. And this, I've got in my mind as I talk to you, this woman has just done that, and she ran, he chased her, he brought her back. The next thing, she was in prison for something that I know she didn't commit.
That's horrendous. It really is. And as you were saying, the impact of the children, do a lot of women, because of our high rates of child removal in our communities, obviously that's another fear that Aboriginal women have, is for the children and the children being taken away, isn't it?
Yes. There's a story I tell of a woman who rang me up about 1 o'clock at night, just after midnight, and she whispered, you know, my name, are you? And I said, yes. And then she asked if she could come and talk to me, but it had to be some place where nobody would know. I actually found out that her story was that she was in domestic violence and the authorities moved in and took her 2-year-old child and put him into care. They didn't give her any support or help. It wasn't even a suggestion that she could try to get out of that relationship. And remember, this is a perception that this violence is Aboriginal cultural practice, and it's not. The violence we're talking about today is nothing. It's nothing related to Aboriginal culture. It's the violence we're seeing today is very much about distressed people acting out their pain on each other. So she eventually got out of the relationship over a 4-year period. She fought then to get her son back. She got him back just after he was 7 years of age. And then the school contacted her and said that she needed to be aware that her son was exhibiting suicidal tendencies, and so she needed to take him to somebody to address those issues. And she was terrified because she felt that if she went to any authority, and that the son and that they decided that the son was suicidal, that they would take her son off her again. In fact, the son had been sexually abused when he was in placement. So
he was more vulnerable while he was in an institution than at home.
Yes, he was. Or in placement, I don't know. I never found out from her whether he was in an institution or whether he was in placement with a foster family. So I just want to make that clear. But I guess then, you know, back then, they didn't respond to her needs as a woman who was in domestic violence, because the assumption was, well, this is just black power stuff. Yeah. But they took the child. And then when they realised, the school realised, that the child was in crisis, their response was to put more pressure on her. Her call to me at 1 o'clock was to make sure that she was never identified as an Aboriginal woman in anything. And so she rang me thinking that I'd be able to do things without going to any of the Aboriginal organisations.
So there was a perception there that her Aboriginality would hurt her more with the authorities.
That's right. Absolutely. So, Annie, what I've described for you here, I think is a set of complex issues, and I've ranged a lot over many of those issues. You asked a simple question, in a way, about shelters. A shelter is one part of a response to a whole problem, and this problem is very different to the kinds of problems that non-Aboriginal women are facing.
Yeah.
And yet I do not see the will of the state to respond to those problems. I can see, for example, you know, we'll continue to talk about the removal of children. Or where is the response to the Bringing Them Home report? We've got increasing incarceration rates, and they're getting worse. Juvenile detention rates were getting worse. We have more and more children who are being suspended or expelled from schools, and I'm specifically talking about New South Wales now, without the schools understanding that the child's behaviour in the school system is telling them a story. And if they put better programs into the schooling system where it is mandated that children have to be now, they're sending out these truant officers and people like that, the children will start to feel that school is a safe place to be, and that's what it should be for children. And then if the children feel safe there, and we know this because we're doing this work, the mothers and the grandmothers will come into the school to find out why their kids and their grandkids love being at school. And then we start to hear the stories of how difficult it is for the mums and what's happening for their lives. Now, if we can't refer those women to the programs that should be in that town, even if there's 67 different programs in that town not responding to any of these needs, but if we can't refer women to programs and the shelter's not working for them, where are we in all of this? It's a bigger, bigger discussion than, yes, we're closing down shelters.
Yeah.
It's a mess.
Do you feel that, yeah, as we were talking about before, the national conversation has been very limited around women's shelters?
Yes.
Even though there's not a lot of conversation even about that, has it been, yeah, limited in that sense?
I'm beginning to understand that governments themselves can't hold complex issues and then work in trying to make, you know, a way forward. In fact, I don't actually think this federal government cares. That's how I feel at the moment. I'm incredibly disappointed in what the Australian governments, whether they're Labor or Liberal or Labor, are doing. And I want to reiterate this. You know, I mean, when I go to PNG, I open up my workshops on family violence come into recovery with the rights of the child. Tom Karma taught me this. So I work through the rights of a child to be able to live in a safe environment without violence, to be fed, to be looked after. Then I look at human rights and I explore that in relationship to women and to men. And then I look at Indigenous rights before we even get into the issue of domestic violence or gender-based violence, as they call it up there. In Australia, people, Aboriginal people want to talk about family violence. So going back to your question, I think it's simplistic. And, you know, I really do respect the present Australian of the year, the focus on what's been talked about. That's her business. But the business that we have to be about as Aboriginal people are much bigger than that. It's much more complex than that. It's about how police are confused when they enter a domestic and they lay charge on both a man and a woman.
Yes.
How the system itself will remove children without supporting that woman in some way. How the mental health system can allow a man who's clearly got an acquired brain injury, a mental health issue, not to get the services that he needs. It's all part of a whole.
You've been working on these issues for a very long time. I mean, they're such complex issues, and even when you look at incarceration, you look at health, mental health, you see the incapability of governments to even begin to address it. Is there a point where you just feel sometimes it's almost an intractable situation, and that is just going to continue getting worse?
There are days when I come home after I've been out somewhere working and I curl up in bed for a day and think the world's screwed. I could use an F word, but I won't. That there's some pretty heavy things happening, and I think, what's the use, you know? What's the future for our children? And then the next day I get out of bed and I make a few phone calls and I feel re-energised again. I need to share with you a really good story. My daughter is working at a university at the moment, and she is choosing not to work as an academic but to work with Aboriginal people coming into the system who want to get into undergraduate degrees. So she's doing the pre-entry support for students in their first, you know, to do the units that will allow them to enrol in a university. And she met up with a woman who then told her her story of living through, an Aboriginal woman, living through horrendous domestic violence, and how it affected her children and how she got out of it. And so my daughter was inspired by this woman's thinking that all her children and her needed to do TAFE courses together, and now university courses together. And the really good news is that seven members of that family have all enrolled together in a degree. That's amazing to me. And my, you know, academic headspace says, my God, because I believe in education. I think education is the answer at every level. Education for early childhood, education for lifelong learning. You're never too old to learn. In fact, we've got a beautiful old fellow living with us at the moment, and he's been a labourer all his life out in the paddocks, you know, a real pushy and Aboriginal man. And he's doing the pre-entry course as well. And he's getting Ds and HDs. He's doing so well. So education for healing. And this family, it typifies that. The mother got out of that bad relationship. She had bones broken. She was hospitalised, all sorts of awful things. And she and her children and her children's partners have all enrolled, the seven of them, in a master's course at a university. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So there's like there's little stories of hope dotted all around Aboriginal Australia that could, in a way, help break the cycle, even if governments don't step up to the plate.
Yeah. And even the children, you know, even the children have got agency in ways that their behaviour may kind of rock you at times, and they may use swear words that you've never heard in your life before. But you know what? They have agency. You know, some of the children teach us, you know. She's the one that wants to make sure that those children are not going to be harmed in the way she was harmed. Yeah.
Yeah, it's children, I think, are the strength of our communities and the most inspiring. I guess they're the next generation, aren't they? And we have to keep working for them in a sense.
I like to say that actually we are now today our children's future. And if we want to talk about sovereignty, we need to start to understand what that means. Because if we stopped playing all the political games and we started to focus on our children, that future for us, in two, three generations, we would be an incredibly powerful group of people able to start to re-energise this country.
And that's a good way to end, with the power of children. Tomorrow, Tiger will be back. We'll be talking to Priscilla Collins, who's head of the North Australian Aboriginal Justice Agency up in the Top End. So it'll be another hard-hitting show, I think. We'll be discussing issues around paperless arrests and also looking at ICE in the territory, which will have a lot of applications over here. But thanks for listening, and looking forward to talking again tomorrow. See you later.